Hello, I'm Mark Steiner, and welcome. We begin our conversation today with Catherine Ebon, who is an investigative journalist, author of the Fortune magazine investigation on Fast and Furious, a six-month investigation, fascinating article, and joins us here by phone today. And Catherine, welcome. Good to have you with us.
Thanks for having me.
So did I pronounce your last name correctly? You say Ebon?
Actually, I say Eban.
Eban, gotcha. All right, I'll get it right next time I say it. So let's begin. This thing has captured clearly the mind of America, watching Congressman Issa and the hearings and Attorney General Holder being held for contempt. But what your article points out is the kind of complexity of what really happens with the DEA in Arizona. And it was just walk us through that a bit, because I think that is this is a whole idea of what the DEA can do, what they can't do, what role prosecutors play, the where the Arizona gun laws themselves fit in. So lay some of that out for our listeners who may not be reading Fortune magazine.
Sure. And let me just say, it's the ATF.
What did I say? DEA? I meant yeah. ATF. Excuse me.
Easy to mix up. But it's
right.
The Bureau of Alcohol, Tobacco, oh,
and
firearms
yes.
Explosives.
Yes, the much maligned.
And they are the overseers and regulators of firearms in America. Let me boil this down to what has been alleged in Congress and what our article states. So Congress has basically alleged, and it became the grounds for holding Eric Holder in contempt, that the ATF had an operational tactic to walk guns in Fast and Furious. And what that means, walking guns, that even though they had the ability to seize guns from that were purchased illegally from gun stores, they chose not to because they had a plan to track the guns into the hands of Mexican drug cartels and make arrests. And the reason that all of this matters is because in December of 2009, December 2010, a Border Patrol agent named Brian Terry was found gunned down on the border between Arizona and Mexico, and two guns purchased by the Fast and Furious suspects under investigation by ATF were found at his murder site. So this became the basis for this explosive congressional inquiry, which has basically led by Representative Daryl Issa, which has made the claim that ATF had this operational tactic to allow the guns to flow to Mexico. Fortune did a six-month investigation. We reviewed 2,000 internal confidential ATF documents, interviewed 39 people with knowledge of the case, and basically came to a rather opposite conclusion, which is there was no operational tactic by ATF to walk guns, but rather ATF agents who were seeking to seize guns were thwarted by prosecutors who were telling them that they did not have the legal grounds to make the gun seizures.
Now, one of the things that I and kind of extrapolating from your article, you raised the issue but couldn't really answer it because it hasn't been answered yet, is what was at the bottom of that? That the reluctance of prosecutors to allow wiretapping by the ATF to go after these alleged gun traffickers. What are you looking at now that may speak to what the either political climate was or what was going on that would have stopped this investigation from pushing ahead?
Well, just to be clear, they did allow wiretapping, and in fact, that was the plan because prosecutors had determined that there were not legal grounds to seize the firearms in questions. The plan B that they came up with was to put up a wiretap and try to gather enough evidence of communications between the cartel recruiters and the straw purchasers that would enable the ATF to make these arrests. But really the issue is that, yes, even though guns were flowing to Mexico, what my investigation exposes is that prosecutors were making the judgment call that within the law, the ATF did not have the needed evidence to prove that, A, the gun sales were illegal, and, B, evidence that there was probable cause of suspicion to believe that these guns were going to the cartels.
And then there was the internal strife in the ATF branch itself that you read about, that John Dotson, who was the agent who kind of broke the story that we are walking guns, that this is allowed to happen, the email that he talked about that the congressional committee put forth that you talk about in your article from the head of the branch itself, Agent Toth, that this is all, again, not as clear cut as it seems we hear every night on Fox and other television.
Well, what's clear is that there was severe conflict between the agents within Group 7, that Dodson and two allied agents had tremendous animus against Dave Voth. They behaved in ways that some have said were insubordinate towards their supervisor, and a subsequent internal ATF investigation of death threats received by Voth stated that six ATF agents, they didn't name them, basically had so much animus against Voth that they had malicious intent to make him the subject of a nationwide libel campaign.
Folks, you can join. I'm sorry, go finish your saying. I'm sorry, Catherine.
I was just going to say that, you know, my article really exposes a context in which some of the allegations and the documents got generated. But what's interesting is that some of the documents that are being held up by Congress as proof that guns were walked don't actually say that. They make inferences about what the documents mean, but if you place those documents in this context that I'm describing, they mean something completely different.
And in a few minutes, we'll be joined by, as you know, Robert Van Bruggen, who wrote the pieces for the National Review on this. And in one of the pieces in his that he wrote for the National Review Online, it talks about how the House Oversight Committee, in response to your story, says Fortune's story is a fantasy made up and almost entirely of accounts of individuals involved in the reckless tactics that took place in Operation Fast and Furious, and that you didn't listen to what they had to say when they gave you other leads indicating that your primary source may be facing criminal charges.
Well, I can respond to those two points.
Yeah.
You know, one is I had obviously extensive discussion with them before this article went up. They made a series of points to me, some of which they have been telling lots of journalists in America this for 18 months. Everything they told me I took very seriously and I looked into. Some of it I included, some of it I did not, and some of it I did not agree with or find to be relevant. So, you know, that's sort of number one on that. You know, I have, after weighing a lot of evidence, I've come to a different conclusion than they did. So I guess their comment does not surprise me particularly.
Well, one of the things that's surprising, I think, that most Americans don't know, I mean, every state has its own set of gun laws. Here we're broadcasting from the state of Maryland that has very strict gun laws. Mm-hmm. As a matter of fact, you can't go to another state with a Maryland driver's license and buy a gun. As I discovered once in doing a story in Wyoming, you couldn't use a Maryland license to buy guns in Wyoming. But now Arizona has very different laws that affected the ATF investigation.
There is no doubt. So in Arizona, if you're 18 and you have no criminal record, you can, and mind you, at 18, you're not even old enough to buy beer.
Right.
You can walk into a gun dealership and buy 50 AK-47s with cash, with no extra licenses needed, no waiting periods. Now, there are 853 licensed firearms dealers in the Phoenix area, and that's 200 miles from the Mexican border. Okay, and in Mexico, the sale of firearms is prohibited. So even if you know nothing about this whole situation, that very setup tells you something, which is, you know, the Sinaloa cartel really used Phoenix as its gun supermarket. And what they were doing was recruiting straw purchasers, 18-year-old kids with clean records, to go in and buy these guns. It's a tremendous, tremendous problem. So that is really the setup behind Fast and Furious. You know, the other issue here is you have to, when you go in to buy a firearm, you fill out a form called a 4473, and it has a box in which you have to certify that you're buying the guns for themselves. And lying on that form is a felony. So presumably under the law, you wouldn't be able to check that box, then walk out and transfer the firearms to somebody else. But in Arizona, and there is a lot of documentation to support this, the prosecutors made the judgment that if you are the rightful owner of that gun, and you are if you just bought it in the gun store, you are free to change your mind and transfer the guns to somebody else. Even if you walk out of the gun store and transfer them to somebody else in the parking lot, because you are free to change your mind. So that was the determination made by prosecutors, and that is why it was so hard for the ATF agents to present evidence that satisfied prosecutors in their analysis of the laws.
So let me bring into the conversation, we're talking with Catherine Eben, who wrote the piece on Fast and Furious for Fortune magazine, a six-month investigation. Robert Verbruggen is a deputy managing editor for National Review and has been following this case as well. And has some very interesting things to say about the case as well, and joins us now. And Robert Verbruggen, welcome. Good to have you on the Mark Steiner Show.
Good to be here.
So this case unfolds. And one of the things I think that both of you have kind of worked with, in a sense, is really important, because I think that most of the TV media, most of the things that you hear on the coming out of Congress do not touch the complexity of this, but kind of make it into what I think, and you can comment on this, Robert, and Catherine's response, into kind of a almost simplistic political argument. But there's a lot more here than meets the eye.
That's right. That's right. It's been very difficult to sort of get to the bottom of everything that's happened, and there are a lot of different dimensions to it.
Well, talk about what that means from your perspective, what you've been writing.
Well, I mean, I think there are a couple of different elements to it. One is the history of gun walking. You know, you had a program during the Bush administration called Operation Wide Receiver that sort of dabbled in it a little bit in a slightly different way, and that was canceled. They decided not to keep going with it, but then it was brought back in the Obama administration. There's a question of why, you know, why did that happen? Why did they decide to do that? And then there's the question of why exactly were they walking the guns? I mean, we really haven't gotten to the bottom of this yet. One element of it is, as the Fortune piece pointed out, that prosecutors have a hard time trying these cases, especially in an area of the country that's as pro-gun as Arizona. It is difficult to prove that somebody bought a gun with somebody else in mind. But as I pointed out, I mean that doesn't completely explain it, because there's a lot of evidence that people were letting guns go even when they did have the evidence to stop the guns. So it's just a really complicated case with a lot of different situations, and you have thousands of guns that walked. The question is, what were the situations with all of those guns?
And Catherine, what did you find in terms of that Robert was just kind of describing, that about the idea that guns did walk and they could have stopped certain instances but did not?
Well, you know, I think that is very, very unclear, because, you know, you can say, and it's fine for subordinate ATF agents to be out on the street and say, hey, I've got all this evidence that this is an illegal purchase, you know, and I want to seize these guns. And they have testified that in certain cases they were directed or pulled off surveillances, directed not to seize guns. Well, what does that really mean? Is it because there is a plot or a tactic to walk guns, or is it because the lead case agents or the supervisor are being directed by prosecutors not to seize the guns? You know, in this instance as well, the investigation became part of what's called the Organized Crime Drug Enforcement Task Force, an OCDEF case. That provided for additional resources, Justice Department resources, but it also put the case more firmly under prosecutors' directives and control. So it is, I am told, customary in an OSADEF case for agents to constantly be in dialogue with prosecutors who are really directing the cases in a stronger way than they otherwise might have been. You know, so to what extent did that play a role? I think that all of these are very important aspects of what really went on in this case.
And folks, by the way, you can join us here at 410-319-8888 as we continue our look at Fast and Furious with two people who have covered this in an incredibly interesting investigative piece done in Fortune magazine, written by one of our guests, Catherine Eban. Robert Verbruggen joins us, deputy managing editor of the National Review, because people cover this as a political issue, but the question is, what is really going on underneath of it? One of the things I've thought about in reading our article, Catherine, also reading the things you've been writing, Robert, are that here we have the Department of Justice. All the players work for the Department of Justice. We now have this piece that you wrote about, Catherine, about the two top suspects, the Sinaloa cartel and being FBI informants. Mm-hmm. The FBI also works for the Department of Justice, and the U.S. Attorney's Office work for the Department of Justice, as does Eric Holder, who runs the Department of Justice. So, I mean, this is the part I think that maybe drives some people crazy, not understanding how all these connected parts can't connect.
Well, that, you know, you make a very interesting point, and I'm not sure I thought about it exactly in that way. But, you know, we have a sort of long, well-documented history now in this country of all kinds of law enforcement snafus and intelligence failures because the different, units, departments, bureaus of our sprawling law enforcement agencies, you know, didn't communicate enough with each other, didn't communicate well. I mean, I think there's probably, you know, some issues there that can be looked at, but I don't think it changes necessarily the fundamental issue on the table, which is Congress has clearly stated that there was an operational tactic to walk guns and that chosen tactic led to the death of this Border Patrol agent. You know, and my article is stating, wait a second, you know, the case that there was an operational tactic is weak and far from clear.
And that, Robert Verbruggen, is an important point, is it not?
Yeah, I think that there is a little bit more evidence, though, that there was at least some sort of tactic or at least some sort of widespread problem here. I mean, we have emails from people who are fairly high up in the Justice Department talking about the number of guns that have walked. And you don't say, you know, a gun walked when you didn't have any way of stopping it. You say a gun walked when something happened that you let it go. And the other thing I think that got neglected in the Fortune piece is that we have numerous gun dealers who have come forward who said that they were told by the ATF to sell guns in situations that they would not have sold them previously. And that's different than a prosecutor, because a gun owner is actually told by the ATF, if you suspect that a person is buying a gun illegally, don't sell it to them. That's the normal direction that the ATF gives to gun dealers. Regardless of what happens after the guns leave the store, the ATF told these gun dealers to just go ahead and sell guns to anybody who wanted them and just let us know when you think they're being illegally sold. So I think that those pieces of evidence do indicate that there was some sort of gun walking tactic, in addition to the basic problem, which I concede exists, of it being very difficult to prosecute straw purchasing cases.
Go ahead, Catherine.
If I could just respond to that. On the first count, what there is a lot of very clear evidence that ATF and the agents involved were briefing not just ATF supervisors but Justice Department officials. Here's our case. Here's how many guns our suspects have purchased. Here's how much cash they used to pay them with. That's very different than saying, here's how many guns walked. So, you know, when there are these claims of a cover-up, and, Justice Department officials have claimed, I wasn't told, I didn't know about the tactics. It's kind of a circular process. Well, didn't know about what? They knew that guns were being purchased. But maybe they didn't know that guns were being walked because, in fact, they were not being walked. So that's one issue. And I just want to tell your listeners that regarding the gun dealers and the ATF's relationship with the gun dealers, we are going to be putting out a statement on that online shortly. But, you know, there is evidence that ATF has made statements and claims that they have, you know, they needed the gun dealers' cooperation. But the cooperation that they needed was for the gun dealers to tell them, hey, there's a suspicious purchase going down. Hey, some guy came in and made multiple purchases. Hey, here's this license plate number in the parking lot. They were asking the gun dealers for that kind of cooperation. They were not necessarily encouraging or requiring them to sell guns. But as I said, we will be responding to that issue at greater length.
And we look forward to that. I mean, I want because there are so many things in that are coming out now that I think there are a couple of questions to ask you before we move on to the next subject and hopefully talk with you all more in the coming weeks about this as it unfolds. But one of the things in your article, Catherine, that striking is that some of these purchases that were made for tens of thousands of dollars, more than that, made with people who are unemployed, who are getting food stamps, and that wasn't enough to kind of open a door and say, well, maybe we should allow a wiretap. Maybe we should allow some arrest and investigation.
Oh, I mean, absolutely. You know, it's clear that in those cases, the dynamic was these ATF agents are effectively bashing their head against the wall. How is it that we are not getting permission to make these seizures? You know, and prosecutors were calling the law as they saw it.
So I'm curious what both of you think, starting with Robert Verbruggen and then going to Catherine Ebon, that America clearly, because this is out there and because of what Congressman Issa's Oversight Committee is investigating, want to know what's going on and want to know why Eric Holder was found in contempt. So I'm curious what both of you think America should know. What should we be investigating? What should be at the bottom of this for us to understand? Robert?
Well, that's a very difficult question because we don't know what's in the documents that he's refusing to turn over. There's a balance of power here between Congress and between Congress and the executive branch, and there's also, you know, concerns about ongoing investigations. So it's actually very difficult to say what he should be turning over specifically to the committee. But what I will say is that, you know, we have a Border Patrol agent who is dead. We have some evidence that the ATF was allowing guns to leave the country. And I think if it's not true, I think he ought to explain how it's not true, and I think he also ought to explain why he retracted the statement, the Justice Department's initial statement that claimed it wasn't true. And if it is true, I think he needs to explain how it happens. I think the American people deserve an explanation as to that, regardless of the specific documents that are turned over.
I would have to agree with what he just said. I mean, that makes a lot of sense. No one is saying that this isn't reasonable territory for a congressional investigation, certainly. You know, but the question and the one that I really focused on is what actually happened in Phoenix,
right,
in Phoenix Group 7 and inside of the ATF.
And that's why I think that your article was so important, Catherine, that you wrote. I mean, I think it opens doors that most of the media right now has not allowed to have opened, and we really need, people do want to get to the bottom of it, but we have to get the real story. And kind of part of the problem with all this, I think, in America right now is if we can get kind of the partisan politics out of it and let real investigation take place, that kind of transparency is important for us and for our democracy.
I agree.
Well, I appreciate it. I look forward to talking with you both again and looking forward to these new pieces coming out, Catherine Ebon, and we will be linking to her Fast and Furious article from Fortune magazine and also to Robert Verbruggen's work for National Review and the New Republic. And thank you both so much for taking your time with our listeners today.
Thank you.
Thanks for having me.
Folks, we are going to come back to this. This is something we need to look at with clear eyes and not with the kind of fog of partisan politics to get to the bottom of what's happening in our democracy. And that's part of our job here, I think, on the Mark Steiner Show and in general as journalists in this country. We're going to take a very brief break. And when we come back, we'll be joined by Mark Reuter, who is a reporter for the Baltimore Brew, an incredibly good reporter that has come back to Baltimore and working with the Brew after his years at the Sun and teaching. And take a look at what's going on inside the fire department. We said that Commissioner Clack was going to be with us, but he called us late this afternoon saying he could not come. We may have him on Thursday to continue that conversation about fire company closings and what they mean for Baltimore and all the other issues. We'll also be joined for a brief period by Councilman Pete Welsh, whose bill to allow advertising on the side of fire trucks was passed. So we'll be back with all that in just a minute. Stay with us.